Hello and welcome to Healing From Within. I am your host, Cheryl Glick, and honored to welcome Mike Bond, who has been called the master of the existential thriller by the BBC, and who joins us today to share his talk about his new book, The Last Savannah, based on his real-life experiences fighting elephant poachers in Africa, which is a continually enormous and escalating problem, with more than 1,000 elephants killed in Kenya alone since 2010. We may also introduce Mike's new book, House of Jaguar, and we'll be talking about that later. Hello, Mike.
Well, hi, Cheryl. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
Oh, we're going to have a very interesting show. You've had a very adventuresome. There's many words I could use to describe it, but I think adventuresome is really good. Mike, as listeners of Healing From Within know, we seek to inform the public by providing speakers who, with the highest values and respect, for just treatment for all life on the planet. In offering the views and life experiences of these conscious awakened citizens, we strive to show that human evolution is connected to our spiritual energies and are reflected in how well we protect the human population, our resources, the animal kingdom, and the planet. So in today's episode, Mike Bond, who is a best-selling novelist, environmental activist, advisor to U.S. and foreign governments, international energy expert, war and human rights correspondent, and award-winning poet who has lived and worked in remote, dangerous parts of the world, including 30 countries on 6 continents, and has been a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate from Montana, and a former anchor for the PBS new program, European Journal, will share his unparalleled experiences as a human rights advocate, along with his views on environmental issues, including elephant slaughter and species decline in Africa, worldwide habitat loss, whales, wolves, seals, and many endangered species, along with ideas on renewable energy and climate change. Mike, we might begin with something of your early life, as sometimes the seeds for a soul's life journey and entrance begin very early on.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, and we never know, do we, Cheryl, how much of it is in our genes and how much of it is in our very early life. But in my case, my early life, I was always anxious to explore. The first few years of my life, we were fortunate to live right next to a rather large and extensive forested area. And I spent my early years out in the forest, wandering the forest, always trying to see what was over the next hill, Cheryl. That was always what excited me, was the unknown.
So it was within you and around you, and I'm sure your family also supported you.
Well, to a certain extent they did, but we were quite impoverished. And I remember one time my parents had finally gotten me a pair of new shoes, which was a big thing. And I went down that day into the forest and managed to get stuck in quicksand and lost one of the shoes. And my father was down there at midnight with a flashlight digging around in the quicksand trying to find a shoe, but we never did.
You know, my first book, Life is No Coincidence. Everything's happening according to a divine plan for each of us, and it's good in the end, and we have to go through this without too much attachment, right, to the physical things in our life. It makes us healthier. Now, you do say at the age of 19, you were, well, in a place where the Algerian Revolution was taking place, and you went on foot across the Sahara. How did you get there at the age of 19?
Well, I'd given up on college in the States and drove a truck for a while to make enough money to go to Europe and to try college there, and I didn't like it any better in France. So I didn't like university in France. So I took off across the Mediterranean to Algeria, and I just decided I'd try to get to Timbuktu, which, you know, it's funny, Cheryl, it's kind of a mythical place, and it shows up in so much ancient history, the desire to get to this mythical Timbuktu, which is at the bottom, the south end of the Sahara. So I took off from Algiers, the city, the capital, one of the two major cities of Algeria, and I didn't walk all the way. I walked part of the way, but I hitchhiked too, which is one major road that goes south through the Sahara. When I say a major road, it's basically a sand track that disappears often when the wind blows and washes out when the few rains come along. But anyway, that's what I did. I headed south again to try to see what was over the next sand dune.
You know, I'm gonna have to say here that you were probably having guidance from a higher realm or source, whether you were aware of it at that time or not, directing you to some of these remote places and experiences. Now, to most people, myself included, the name Timbuktu sounded to me like a nefarious, romantic place that might not even be real, but just a figment of a great imagination. And it seems to me you're very much like the Vitruvian man of the Middle Ages, that your interests crossed artistic, mechanical, technical, and the spiritual and physical interests of a well-rounded human being in search of perhaps higher truth or awareness. Now, that also could have been your destiny and your plan from the very beginning. Regardless of education, you learned many, many things along the way from many different people, I'm sure. Yeah?
I would say that's true. And you put your finger right on the most important thing, and that is the process of discovery, and which is what mm-hmm. life is all about. And in fact, Aristotle said that finding answers to unknown things is the highest form of life. And discovery, the mystery, I mean, when you think, as you have often talked about, when we look around and there is so much mystery, there's so much that isn't factually clear, and yet life is an amazing gift, it's an astounding, mysterious, infinite gift that we don't understand. And I think that's where the source of my search for the unknown goes.
Yeah, yeah. Came from within your deepest subconscious, or perhaps soul remembrance of other times and places and yeah. energies and creating new ones. Yeah, it goes very deep within each of us. And we are called and given opportunities to remember if we allow it. Mm-hmm. Mike, can mm-hmm. you give us a description of the story and main characters in your novel, The Last Savannah?
Sure. It's basically, and it's wrapped around, utilized as part of my own life, which, as you mentioned earlier, Cheryl, is the process of helping to hunt down ivory poachers in Kenya. And so basically the story is that of a former British commando who's now a rancher in Kenya, a cattle rancher, who he's bored with his life. Cattle ranching is a very boring job. And he's given an opportunity to join an elite anti-poaching squad, and which he does. In fact, he ends up leading it, and he departs with his squad to hunt down poachers. And in halfway or partway through this process, he finds out that the poachers they're hunting have kidnapped, which the poachers often do, three archaeologists. Working in northern Kenya, and one of them is the hero's long-lost love, if you wish, the biblical and the deep connections to the word Rebecca back in our history, our emotional history. But anyway, so the book is really focused on the nature of Kenya, the incredible connections. You can see it clearly in Kenya, the close connections between humans and animals, and the mystic and mysterious and profound way that animals see the world. And they give us some clues. When we're out there in the savannah, there's so many animals, we get a very deep sense of what it's like to be a gazelle, what it's like to be a lion or a leopard or a cheetah or an eagle. So that's what the book is about. It's apparently, a number of people have said, well, many people and reviewers have said that they just can't put it down. It's absolutely thrilling, but at a very deep level, it's reaching out for some kind of understanding of what is life and how do we live a good life.
Yeah, aside from the beautiful writing, the descriptive writing, the intelligent writing, there is a deep sense of longing and looking for the truth about life and love in this book. Now, let's go on to talk about what was the motivating force behind your writing, and what themes are most represented in your novels?
That's a really good question, Cheryl. If I try to go back to what is the single biggest driver in my life and my writing, other than love, I mean, I try to spread as much love I can, whether it's my family, my friends, the total strangers, little animals, from ants to you know what. And but what is the driver in my life is a dream I had one time where I was in a supermarket and I was walking around trying to figure out what it was and where I was, and I ran into this kind of young guy with long hair, and I asked him, I said, what are we here for? And he said, to find out what it is. And I said, what? And he said, life. We are born, we live to find out what life is, the mystery of it, the unbelievable profundity of it. And that's why I write. In a nutshell.
Yeah, beautiful. And you feel it is your personal, perhaps you feel it is your personal responsibility to live without judgment and blame and to just be at peace and at one with nature and the animals and this all of adventure, because all of life is an adventure. So I would think that's a very important goal and theme for you, and you show that. And anyone reading your book will be able to tap into that deep sensitivity. But we'll go on to, do you have any special mentors or people you work with or who have influenced your thinking, your projects, and the values you hold dear?
I the deepest I think that I have from, again, from the very first days of my life that I can remember is a deep connection with Native Americans, which was part of my drive to spend as much time as I did in the wilderness. But it was more the multi-leveled understanding they had of life, and also I would say other teachers. I've spent so much time in the wilderness that I would have to say that wolves are very much teachers to me, and they have been to the human race for 500,000 years. There's a lot of thought among anthropologists that humans learned their family structure largely from wolves, because we were companions over hundreds of thousands of years. And as primates, humans would not have the same kind of, we do not have the same kind of family structure as any other primate species, but our family structure is exactly the same as wolves.
Interesting.
That's very interesting. Hmm. Yeah. And so I learned a lot, Cheryl, from animals. I learned a lot in the past from Carlos Castaneda. He has taught me so much of how to live deeply and how to shrug off the temporal and foolish and focus on the profundity of things. So
now Ian McAdam is your main character. He's a really educated and privileged man, and he's living in a primitive land where so many around him are suffering the indignities of poverty and a very, very challenging lifestyle. How he's described by some of the locals, they don't trust him. There's distrust for him. And of course, this is not a scenario that is limited to Africa or any one set of circumstances. There still is inequality due to different cultures and social structures and economic and political influences all over the world. People face these conditions. But why has he returned to Africa to remain in a somewhat hostile environment, giving up his own British heritage?
He says, Cheryl, and I feel the same way, that Africa is a fever in the sense that once you get it, like malaria, I've got malaria a number of times, and you can't ever shake it once you get it. It's always in your blood. And Africa, once you've gone to Africa and spent deep time there, I'm not talking about a seven-day drive around a national park in a van. I'm talking about a deep connection with Africa. Once you have that, you have it for life. So that's happened to him. And it's not that the locals don't trust him. It's that he fears they don't trust him. He tends to denigrate himself unnecessarily, as many of us do. And you touch on that in your work, because we do that when we're not connected, or when we're not grounded. You know what I mean?
Yes, when we're not in alignment to our highest sense of being, we tend to go into the mind and to perceive things that are illusion and inaccurate. And the reality is being in alignment to the highest and best of us. And you say that Africa teaches us to have no attachment. You actually write this, to see the world as it passes, not siding with lion or gazelle, but the need of nature and the strongest to survive. So the natives there believe God is in the land, the trees, the mountains, the animals, the sky, the rivers, and the rain. And the missionaries who came said God would free us of our sins, but in destroying the land and the natural way of life, they killed a part of God, right? This is some of the things you write. And then a consequence for these remote lands is that medicine without birth control allowed the weak to live, populations to explode, and the limitless savannas and jungles to be destroyed along with the natural way and order of life. That's a pretty powerful statement. Yeah, when we bring change that already there was something beautiful going on and natural, and what we thought we would bring, you know, we would try to bring good in our pursuits, but actually we didn't.
No, that's an interesting point, because as I wrote it, I talked about we used to send care ships to Africa full of medical gear, and I myself, in the Himalayas and elsewhere, I've given people simple things to make a child survive, you know, like penicillin and. But when we allow, because in Africa, for instance, what happens is wealth is considered to be dependent on the number of children you have. So there would be nothing for a man to have 20 children, but he can't afford to feed them all. So, and also what happens too, Cheryl, is in Africa, the land gets divided up among the children. So if you have enough land to support one family and you have 20 children, you've got to divide it up into little tiny pieces and nobody can live off it anymore. So Africa's gone through an absolute population explosion and no longer can feed itself without tearing out the last of the wild lands and killing the last elephants and lions. And you know, the elephant situation is, when I was a young man in Kenya, there were 10 million elephants, and today there's about 400,000 in all of Africa, and they're being killed at the rate of 100 a day by poachers, mostly to feed the Chinese market. But it's an absolute tragedy, and in 10 years the elephant will be gone from Africa unless we change.
That is what this show and what we're talking about right now. Change.
Absolutely.
It's necessary to change. It's necessary to change people who have 20 children when they can support it and support them, and to think more responsibly and consciously for the highest good of all, the animals and the families that we have, and to do what's in everyone's best interest. That's what we're talking about today. Now, you also described relationships, and in describing McAdam's wife, Dorothy, and the shame felt for her behavior in front of his friend, Nehemiah, I actually experienced, by reading that, what I see in far too many women of today, which is self-absorption and limited interest in the world. So your character, McAdam, describes it this way: "But my shame's why she drinks," he realizes. He remembers her years back kissing the kids into bed, her rough, loving voice. Her drinking was the wall between her and herself. So the question is, did you mean to suggest that their failed marriage was the reason for her unhappiness and his own, or was it lack of emotional and spiritual development?
You know, again, that's a wonderful question, and my take on it, Cheryl, would be simply that unless we can evolve personally, individually, deeply, and really reach out for understanding in the world, then we're going to have a failed marriage, because either we have to be complete in ourselves, and I don't mean alone all the time, I just mean we have to be on the search. No one's ever complete, but we have to be on the search. And when we give up the search, when we accept the humdrum of life, when we kind of turn on the TV and and shut our brain down, that's when we become a limited person. And when we become limited, it's hard to have a good relationship.
Absolutely.
Everybody has to, I would just say everybody has to follow their own path at the same time as following the path of a partner or a loved one, or keeping company with
yeah.
that person.
Yeah, what it is, you just said it so well, it's a personal responsibility for your own development and continued interest in the world and life. And nothing out there can give it to us It comes from within, this source of joy and awe for life. Yeah, you just said it so beautifully. I thank you for that.
Well, I think both writing and reading, this is my take on this too, Charlotte, is, and they are, writing and reading are both healing from within, to use your term. And I encourage absolutely everyone to write, everyone. And to write not only about our own personal concerns, but as well about how we imagine other people's personal concerns. And when we try to emphasize with someone we don't like, for instance, we find we don't like someone, when we try to empathize and look at the world from their point of view and write a page about how they see the world, suddenly our heart breaks open and just expands. And I just absolutely believe everyone
should
write.
Well, that's a concept, of mirroring. Sometimes when we see in someone else what we don't like, we actually have a kernel of that within ourselves, deep, buried deep, and we need to work on ourselves more. And that will improve the relationship with ourselves, for ourselves, more self-love, and with everybody else. You know, you also write, struggle, change, and the law of survival of the fittest, as well as love and losing yourself within a relationship, are important issues that Rebecca, who was Ian's past girlfriend, notices when she is captured and held for ransom and then saved later by Ian, the main character. And this seems to be another major theme of your novel. Tell us your observation on Rebecca and the issues she was working with.
That's very interesting. That Rebecca was to some extent a frozen person. And in so many of all of us, to a certain extent, risk not being able to give because of fears more than anything else in ourselves. And so it was very difficult for her to admit the extent to which she loved McAdam. And so this again, it's because she had not gone all the way down her own path, that she couldn't ride, she couldn't be together with McAdam on his path. And we have to stop seeing the negative in ourselves and at the same time be very honest critics of ourselves so that we don't fool ourselves into think we're more positive or helpful or good than we actually might be.
She was afraid to lose herself in a deep love. And it sounds to me like we know that the mind or thought rules the body, right? The body believes what the mind tells it to. So her body her mind was telling her body to run from love because ultimately she would not be able to sustain it. And she feared losing it. So she, even before she had it, she was afraid of losing it. So when she rekindles this intimate relationship, you do show a lot of truisms about love, fear, and the human problems between men and women. Because you write, Ian says to her, "I'd have rather been with you. Hasn't that been true for years? You bring it out of me, love, and the refusal to lie about it." But Ian also knew, written on her face, a harsh expression that would turn her from any man she loved. In her hunger to be free, she'd always be alone. Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, you wrote that. And it's quite wonderful, because what we're trying to help people realize on this show is that they must conquer their fear and allow the beauty of their inner wisdom to come out. It's an effort. It's a consistent effort to recognize your fears and not engage in them, and to work on other means to restore your true value for life and love, as we're doing here. So I want to thank you, Mike Bond, for sharing the amazing story, The Last Savannah, of a faraway land, Africa, mirrored in both the beauty and tragedy of life and death, and the natural play between man and nature, their needs and desires. For more information and to purchase this book, go to MikeBondBooks.com. Jaguar.com. And Mike, you also have a new book out, House of Jaguar, just being released. Can you tell the audience how they can purchase that book?
All my books, Cheryl, are available through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com if you shop online, and they're available either as an ebook or as a print book. And also, most local bookstores or Barnes & Noble will have them. If they don't have them, they can order them. And you also can usually find them at the public library, so there's no need to even buy them if you can get them that way. And I'm just going to say that the main character is injured in the Guatemalan jungle and trying to find his way out. And he runs into a black panther, a jaguar, who actually, he's afraid for his life. But the jaguar instead leads him out of the jungle, leads into water, and then leads him out of the jungle. And it's happened in my own life as well.
Oh, that's beautiful. So, I'll have to read that. In summarizing today's episode of Healing From Within, we have shared certain illuminating insights into human emotions and the drives that bring out the best and worst in our interactions with our fellow journeyers on this story, this continuing story of self-discovery, love, fear, and the need for surviving in a world of conflicting possibilities, making this life challenging, yet exciting. In the duality between spirit and physical life, we learn that freedom of the soul is perhaps the only reality worthwhile. As Mike writes in the final chapter, humans in their groping, inessential cruelty seemed not evil, but subjects of an infinite condolence. Ian smiled up at her approaching him, and in the beauty of the slanting sun against her hair, thought, I could share her with 1,000 men, share her with all life. Nothing would matter. I don't care. I'm free. So it seems to me, and I hope to our listeners, that the focus should not be on finding love in one person or one place, not in one experience, but in all our enterprises. The focus must be on finding the truth within that leads to acceptance, allowing, and surrendering to all that is, and to live with honor. I am your host of Healing From Within and invite you to listen to authors, their stories and ideas of knowing the world of the seen and unseen, always in search of the meaning and possibilities for creating our healthiest, most wonderful lives. Go to CherylGlick.com or WebTalkRadio.net and DreamVision7Radio.com to hear Healing From Within. Thank you.